For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a Republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the We Don't Have Any Classified Documents edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. The Michigan legislature's 2023 session has officially started. Democrats now controlling both chambers for the first time in 40 years, and I think only the third time in history, have already introduced a raft of high-priority bills.
I'm Walt Sorg, sitting in for Mark Brewer, who is taking a long overdue and highly deserved vacation. The 2024 game of political musical chairs is underway. We'll update the race to succeed Debbie Stabenow in the Senate and the likely domino effect of that race on Michigan's congressional delegation. But before we begin with those issues, Jeff, I think with Mark on vacation, it's a great opportunity to talk behind his back. You know, I've always wanted to do that anyway. But specifically, I wanted to talk about how Mark is really one of the behind-the-scenes heroes of the midterm election. You know, he worked his butt off 70, 80 hours a week, constant vigilance over those who would wreak havoc on the electoral process. And I think it was really a big factor, his work, in keeping the election and post-election period quiet and without a whole lot of controversy. I know you worked closely with Mark on many of his efforts. Where did our friend have his biggest impact?
Well, I think it's great that you mentioned this. And Mark, I know he'd be embarrassed that we were talking about him, so this is a great time to do it. You're right, though. He has been a warrior for democracy. And yes, on behalf of Democratic candidates, by and large, but mostly he's been on the side of democracy, putting country above partisanship. That's what first forged my partnership and friendship with Mark several years ago, when I saw my former party becoming autocratic and anti-democracy. I was concerned about the 2020 election and chaos and the potential for violence and that we saw come true. I had reached out to Mark in the spring of 2020 and said, what are some things that could be done to help prevent this, help protect the free and fair election, protect the process. And, I've got to witness that up close now over the last two election cycles. Mark is a tireless worker, whether it was on behalf of protecting voting rights, access to the ballot, helping pro-democracy candidates get elected, helping thwart anti-democracy candidates. There's just not enough praise that can go his way. You know, his name wasn't on the ballot. It has been in the party since before when he led the Michigan Democratic Party. But you're right when you said that an unsung hero, the Democrats and the coalition that elected Democrats, that includes certainly partisan Democrats, but also centrist moderates, former Republicans who just can't stomach the lunacy and authoritarian behavior coming from their party, voted for Democrats like Gretchen Whitmer and Dana Nessel and Jocelyn Benson and Alyssa Slotkin and up and down the ticket and helped, I think, make Winnie Brinks the majority leader and Joe Tate the speaker. And Mark is a big contributor to all of those efforts.
And also in Wayne County, where we had that incredible mess in 2020, brought about by a lot of angry Republicans who kind of stormed the place. In 2022, it was Mark, it was Chris Thomas, the former state elections director, and it was Jocelyn Benson, along with the local clerks, that made sure that Wayne County was just another county.
We were expecting, I was certainly expecting, much more mayhem and disruption after the 2022 election. But I think so much of the work that was done ahead of time in preparation in educating those who were officially involved in the process really went a long way in helping to mitigate the amount of disruption that the kooks, I call them extreme, but they're really the mainstream of the Republican Party, people like former State Senator Pat Kolbeck and others who exist only to disrupt and break things, they were marginalized. And from the state board of canvassers down to the county boards, we didn't see the kind of wrenches thrown in the gears that we had been anticipating. But that was largely due to work of people like Mark, certainly of Jocelyn Benson and the Republican and Democratic clerks across the state. You know, I think it's something like nearly 90% of the elected clerks in the state are Republicans, election clerks. 90% of our elections are run by Republicans, and not just Democrats. And they're all good professionals who need to be commended for running such a tight ship in the face of such ridiculous, absurd claims, threats, and attempts to undermine people's faith in the democratic process.
Okay, Jeff, that's enough nice things that we've said about Mark. We can go back to being mean to him next week, I guess. And I promise I will never say anything nice about him again.
Yeah, we won't tell him about this.
Oh, yeah. He probably won't even listen because he's on vacation. At least if he's smart, he won't. Let's get to the issues of the day. First of all, an update on the possible candidates for U.S. Senate, with Stabenow surprising just about everybody. Nobody is in the race, but it looks like at least one person is like 90% in, just about ready to jump in 100%, and that's Alyssa Slotkin.
I think it's not much of a surprise to political observers that Slotkin is taking a very hard look at the race, and I fully anticipate she will be a declared candidate before too much longer, would be my read on it. I said on Twitter earlier in the week that if you're betting, bet the farm on her running. I think it's a done deal. But there's no shortage, and we talked about this in the last episode, how deep the Democratic bench is in Michigan. Even after potential candidates like Gretchen Whitmer has said no, Dana Nessel has said no, Dan Kildee has said no, there are still some very strong contenders in addition to Slotkin who are taking a look at the race. Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, chief among them, a lot of stories recently about him taking a hard look at it. There's also word that Jocelyn Benson may not be a hard no, that she might be looking at what the future holds for her. I know she was just reelected to her second term as Secretary of State by a landslide margin. And then she went to Washington last week to receive the Presidential Medal that we talked about in the last episode. Apparently some folks there may have talked with her. It's certainly worth looking at when you have a free run. Don't have to give up office. Gilchrist and Benson would both fit that. They have very little to lose by taking a hard look at this. So whereas Slotkin or Haley Stevens or Debbie Dingell would need to give up their seat in the House in order to run for the Senate. Mallory McMorrow is still a name out there taking a look at the race from what is being reported and from what I'm hearing. And so I think there's a lot of very strong candidates, and I'm sure I'm making the mistake of leaving some potentially strong candidates out. But, you've got some really big potential candidates like Whitmer and Mike Duggan immediately say, no, I'm not interested in running. Your thoughts, Walt, on, the Democratic field. And you talk to still more Democrats than I do.
Well, I'm really intrigued by Gilchrist only because, of course, he works so closely with Governor Whitmer, who is the 2,000-pound gorilla when it comes to this whole nominating process. If she puts her support behind somebody, either privately or publicly, that is big. And it would be tough for her to go against her own lieutenant governor. Yet my sense is that she wants to go in another direction, that she would probably see Slotkin as the most electable because of Slotkin's proven ability to bring independents and even some Republicans into the fold. She's done it three times now. Electability is a big deal. Now, as far as Slotkin, we both got fundraising emails from her last night where she doesn't say she's running, but she all but says it. In the email, let me quote just a little bit of it. It says, Alyssa has gotten a front row seat to Senator Stabenow's pragmatic approach. In fact, Alyssa represents the same area of mid-Michigan that the senator did back when she was a member of the House. And then at the bottom, she says, if you support the Midwestern leadership Senator Stabenow has brought to Michigan, chip in below. It's vital we continue to elect leaders in Congress that know mission-driven still matters. And then a contribute button. And I guarantee you that contribution goes into the Alyssa Slotkin campaign fund. Yeah, she's running.
Well, and her House fund can be transferred up to the Senate.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Any money she raises in the House is applicable to a Senate race. They have the same limits. And so so she's a proven vote getter, a proven tireless fundraiser, and she's been very successful at building a coalition that includes not just Democrats. It's hard, in our zero sum world, you have a partisan label. Alyssa Slotkin has really defied a lot of partisanship, and is focused on many issues, certainly issues that matter to her district. I know she was involved heavily in the, helping bring jobs, the GM jobs into her congressional district in Lansing. That was a big issue in the last campaign.
She was also very big with the semiconductor, the manufacturing, yep, of chips.
But really, her chops are national security, defense, intelligence. She was a CIA officer, she really fits the traditional mold of the post-World War II international defense kind of profile that defied partisanship. Many giants in both parties kind of had those same kind of credentials and interests. The John McCain's or the Sam Nunn's, and there's so many others. Joe Biden, really had these defense and foreign policy and intel that were part of their portfolio in Congress or the Senate, and Alyssa fits that description, that profile, better than anybody else in the race. Though they're all proven vote getters, I'll say it. I like Garland Gilchrist a lot, but it's the moving up the ladder is always tough for a lieutenant governor, not just in Michigan, but in any state. They're always talked about as candidates for senator to succeed to the governorship. It's a very sketchy record if they ever do.
As Brian Kelly and John Cherry.
And so many, ask Dick Postumus, just in recent Michigan history, they've all tried and none has seen, Postumus got close to the River Jordan, but he never wasn't able to cross it. Kelly had his doors blown off in a primary and Cherry never got out of the gates and ended up not even running. It's a very difficult thing. That doesn't mean it's impossible. Certainly, he starts with a statewide platform, access to donors, solid political base, connections in Detroit that are going to be key in a primary, especially if it's a multi-way primary. So I'm not by any means dismissing his electability in a Democratic primary or his electability in a statewide race. It's just always a tough hill for a lieutenant governor to climb, because yes, they're on the ballot, but they're kind of the also ran. They're the underfight, the undercard on the fight night. The people vote for the governor, not the lieutenant governor, and they vote for Jocelyn Benson. They vote for the Secretary of State. She's won two large statewide landslides, so certainly she is a strong candidate. Haley Stevens. It shouldn't be forgotten that she flipped a district that was historically Republican, had been Republican forever, and she was able to flip that district back in 2018. The district that she was elected to in 2022 after redistricting, a strong Democratic base district, but she came from kind of the same centrist, center-left position that Alyssa Slotkin did back in 2018, though I think her positions are viewed as much more mainstream progressive than Alyssa's, which, you know, that could hurt Slotkin in a Democratic primary. If it becomes a race of who's the most progressive candidate, it's tough for Slotkin to win that argument. But that's not the way she would position herself, and not the way she would position herself for a November race.
An interesting addition to the possible Republican candidates who has said that she is in fact interested is Ruth Johnson, a former Secretary of State who won two statewide elections, now state senator. What would make it doubly interesting is both she and Alyssa Slotkin lived in Holly.
Yeah, the Battle of Holly. I know who I think has Alyssa Slotkin has great political instincts. People have said that Ruth Johnson is a useful idiot. I've never found her particularly useful. So I won't argue with the rest of it. Yes, she won two elections statewide as Secretary of State, but she won them in the most quiet and uninteresting manner and without any real ability or effort to build her statewide profile. I think she was one of the most obscure statewide officials in my memory. So if that's what the Republicans have to offer, I say bring it. I think that it's much more likely that you'll see a repeat of something that looks more like the 2022 race for governor on the Republican side, with a Tudor Dixon, I think, a very likely candidate. You could get Christina Caramo, who was their Secretary of State nominee, who was going to lose the state chair race to Matt DiPerno. You could get other from the clown car running for state party chair, like Lena Epstein or somebody like that, with deep pockets in the race. Perry Johnson, deep pocketed loon who didn't even manage to make the ballot as he tried to run for governor. So I think we're going to see a bunch of MAGA misfits who are running. Ruth Johnson, I guess, would fit the profile not quite fitting the MAGA world. She was part of the Senate report that found no wrongdoing in the irregularities in the 2020 election that caused a lot of MAGA's heartburn. So I think she would start off a marked person from Trump world and from the mainstream of the Republican world. Some of the insiders in Lansing, some of the donors who long for the days when Republicans could eat with a fork, might want to look to somebody like Ruth as a candidate. But there are much better options for them that I think would have much more ability to raise money, something Ruth Johnson has never been able to do. People like Peter Meyer, a name that surfaced recently just in some conversations I've had, is Mike Rogers, the former congressman, former chair of the Intel Committee. Now, that would be an interesting race, he versus Slotkin in a potential matchup. You got the FBI versus the CIA. but I think that's not very likely to happen. He's been gone now for, it'll be a decade since his name's been on the ballot.
And there's another Mike Rogers in Congress now who at last news report was drunk on the floor.
Well, yeah, he's the one who tried to go at Matt Gaetz and had to be restrained physically.
That may make him a hero, actually, among some Democrats.
Yeah. The Republicans, they've got a much shallower bench. Somebody who's normal, like Fred Upton, looks at the Republican Party today and the chances of winning and recognizes he doesn't have one in all likelihood. Peter Meyer, the same way, although he has a much, I would say, arguably a better shot to win the Senate primary if the race is crowded than he does at winning an election to Congress in the district that he was just ousted from.
Yeah, Rick Snyder won his primary with 25% of the Republican vote.
Right,
when he was first running, because he had four extreme right-wing candidates against him. One quick story I wanted to tell about Alyssa Slotkin to kind of demonstrate what a great campaigner she is one-on-one. When she was first running in the primary to be the candidate in what was then the 8th Congressional District against a MSU professor by the name of Chris Smith, who's a great guy, very liberal, I dragged my wife, who's not very political, at least she wasn't then, to a house party for Alyssa that was being hosted by some friends of ours. And she kind of agreed to go, mostly because she wanted to see the friends. By the time that evening was over, she was in love with Alyssa Slotkin. She was so enamored of her. And then I remember on election night, when it was determined that she beat Mike Bishop, she actually cheered. And she's looking at me right now through my office door and saying, why are you talking about me on your podcast? But hopefully my marriage will survive that. But Alyssa is a great one-on-one campaigner. She is absolutely tireless. I was campaigning back then on Proposal 2, the anti-gerrymandering proposal. And every time I turned around, there was Alyssa.
She starts off, I think, as the favorite in the field of the list that I've mentioned so far. But there's a lot of game left to play, and nobody has to be that quick to throw their hat into the ring. It's only been a week since Debbie announced this. It was a surprise. I think this is going to take a couple few months before things start to sort themselves out on both sides of the aisle. Is people who are interested take a look, weigh the prospects of the kinds of sums that you're going to have to raise. These candidates are going to probably have to raise somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 to $30 million, either self-fund or raise. And then there's going to be a lot of additional outside money that's brought in. This is going to probably become the most expensive race in Michigan history, or one of the most expensive races, surpassing the 80 million or so that was spent in the governor's race last time. One other name on the Republican side I'd be remiss to not mention is Ronna Romney McDaniel, the chair of the Republican National Committee. I think she's done such a bang-up job losing there, I'd love to see her stay. But she's in real danger now of losing that chairmanship when the Republican National Committee gathers at the end of January in California. And what looked like a slam dunk win for her is now turned into a very dicey prospect. And she might use the prospect of exploring a run for the Senate to kind of, I'll put in parentheses here, quote unquote, gracefully bow out of the RNC race. So if you hear some news of Ronna dropping out of the RNC race to look at running for the Senate, it makes a lot of sense politically for her to try to save a little face by doing that, even if she doesn't ultimately end up running for the Senate.
It would be interesting to see if cousin Mitt Romney came into the state to campaign for under those conditions, but who knows? Who knows?
More Michigan politics with Jeff and Walt after these messages on A Republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm whose principals have more than four decades of experience measuring public opinion on federal, state, and local issues, from who's ahead in a race for governor or Congress, to local support for a proposed zoning change.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, state agencies, local governments, and membership organizations across the state. Whether it's measuring voter opinions about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation enjoys public support, Epic MRA has been Michigan's premier go-to pollster for 30 years.
Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Let's talk about the domino effect of all of these races. You're definitely going to have Slotkin stepping out of the 7th district, which is a swing district. It's 50-50. And the other two possibilities, if you have Haley Stevens running, her district is solid Democratic, and I would assume that Andy Levin would be the odds-on favorite to take that seat. And then, of course, if Debbie Dingell gets in, which I don't think she will, her seat also is pretty solid Democratic. But in the 7th, I reached out to a bunch of people that I thought would be potential candidates, who would all be strong candidates, just to see what they had to say. And I got immediate responses from three of them. Mayor Andy Shore of Lansing and Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram are both actively exploring a candidacy for the 7th. But the odds-on favorite there would be Curtis Hertel, who just left the state Senate because of term limits. He's always been very popular in Ingham County. Hertel name is very prominent nationally as well because of his father and his uncles. But two people that could run and not be risking their current jobs are State Senator Sam Singh and Sarah Anthony, both very popular in Ingham County, which is the Democratic base of the district. And I suspect both of them would run if Curtis Hertel did not. You've also got Angela Whitwer, who's over in the adjoining Eaton County and is now the chair of the House Appropriations Committee and a real rising star in the Democratic Party. State Representative Julie Brixey has said that she hasn't thought about it. It wasn't on her bucket list, but she suggested that Hertel is her choice. It wouldn't surprise me, though, if she jumped in, especially if Hertel doesn't. What do you think about the Republicans to run? Think it's a rerun of Tom Barrett?
Well, I'd love to see a rerun of Tom Barrett. He was one of the shittiest candidates in recent memory. Talk about a lot of hype. All hat and no cattle was the Tom Barrett congressional race. He couldn't raise money when he was arguably the top targeted race in the country. So I know that the folks in Washington would, yes, there was a lot of money invested in Tom Barrett. They have... They would be able to capitalize on some name ID that they helped build. But I know that there was a lot of disappointment in how lackluster his campaign was and how weak the fundraising performance was. I would think that there would be a long look from folks at Washington at former House Speaker and failed Attorney General candidate, twice failed Attorney General candidate, Tom Leonard, in that district. Now, I know Tom Leonard is very good, close friends with Tom Barrett, like in each other's wedding type of friends. So they'll, I would imagine, sort this out between them. But I know that there would be smart people in the Republican Party who would look at Tom Barrett's performance and think that they could probably do better.
Get some others too, but the bench for the Republicans in the district is pretty weak, mostly because the district is dominated by Ingham County, and Ingham County is a very, very blue county at this point, about 60-65% on any given election. A couple other names that occurred to me, you've got the prosecuting attorney in Clinton County, Anthony Spagnuolo, and they got Senator Lana Thies. I think she'd have to move in order to run and still be in the district, although you don't have to live in the district to represent it. And then Norm Schenkel, former state senator, former party chair for both the county and the congressional district, and of course, one of your colleagues on the Board of Canvassers for a while.
The comparison between the benches is pretty apparent. Yeah. Tom Barrett was a state senator, represented 100% of the district that he represented for 4 years, is in the congressional district. And, you know, there was, what was it, something like $20 million spent on his behalf. So there is some appeal to him being a repeat candidate. I can't discount that. Somebody like Tom Leonard would be considered a first-tier recruit. The rest of the names that you mentioned there are really would be seen as not even B-list candidates, but C or D-list candidates. Lana Thies is a joke within the Republican world. I would tell, Senate Majority Leader Winnie Brinks that they should make Lana Thies an honorary member of the Democratic caucus because she did as much as anybody to help elect that caucus when she singled out Mallory McMorrow last spring for, her kind of vitriolic attempt to try to capitalize and raise money on what she labeled Mallory McMorrow a groomer at the time, and McMorrow was having none of that and turned it into like more than $3 million that she rolled into helping elect the Senate majority. So that was a direct fallout from Lana Tice's unforced error.
And she's also got Donald Trump against her.
Right, right. She did manage to win a primary against a Trump-endorsed candidate, but she only won 60-40 in her own backyard. To think that she could somehow translate that into support across the entire congressional district. And she's somebody else who has no ability to raise any money. I mean, she can't raise legitimate money for real grown-up legislative campaign, let alone a congressional campaign. And so, the district was one of the most hotly contested races in 2022. Its precursors were hotly contested in the last few elections. But, I really think that the new iteration of the district now, the 7th district, really now does tilt ever so slightly in the Democratic's candidate's favor, whoever that candidate is. Joe Biden won it in 2020 by a couple of points. And it's very likely that Biden is going to be on the ballot again. And it's very likely that Trump will be on the ballot again. And so it's very likely that in that district, there will be a little bit of tailwind for the Democratic candidate.
Let's take a look at a few other issues before we wrap up for this week. First of all, you mentioned in the open that the legislature began its session yesterday, and immediately both the House and the Senate announced introductions of bills by the majority party that pretty much outlined their immediate priorities for the legislative session. What's your thoughts on, should they start with something that's kind of a slam dunk for a bipartisan vote, which would be a tax cut of some form? It turns out Republicans are in favor of increasing the earned income tax credit, which Gretchen Whitmer has been fighting for a couple of years. Or should they dive right into the very divisive and very partisan issues of right to work policy and the prevailing wage law, two things that are high priorities for Democrats and something that's anathema to Republicans and their supporters in big business?
You hit the nail on the head. They should, I think, start off with something that would have more across the board appeal, like repealing the pension tax and increasing the earned income tax credit. If they can do that with bipartisan support, great. If they can do it without Republican support, that's fine too. I think that's the kind of issue that hits that two-thirds, three-quarters support across all voters in the state. When you get into issues like right to work, like prevailing wage, I understand how they're part of the agenda. I don't dispute that they're likely to do something on that, or wouldn't even advise them not to do something like that. But as the first thing out of the chute with slim majorities in both chambers, I would not, just as a matter of optics and politics and good policy, do that right out of the chute. I would get some traction underfoot, build up some success in some other areas before taking on those issues and figure out a way how to tackle those issues in a way that can still keep the coalition that help elect Democrats statewide and deliver those majorities in the legislature that included a lot of support from business leaders, business groups, and business support, how to find a win-win even when tackling those issues like right to work and prevailing wage.
I find it interesting that one of the three proposals that were passed overwhelmingly by voters in the midterm election in Michigan is not on the list, and that is ethics reform. That was a part of the expansion of the term limits, the revision of term limits in the legislature. And it is something that in the past has gotten through the state house on a unanimous vote. Yet that bill apparently has not been introduced, or at least it was not on the list that was distributed of the immediate priorities, although the implementation of the right to choose legislation is in that list. But do you think that's a mistake? Because I think it's overwhelmingly popular amongst the populace. It really did failed in the previous legislature because the then Senate Majority Leader, Mike Shirky, didn't like it.
I do think it's a mistake. I know that you can't do everything all at once. They can do more than one thing at once, but they can't do everything all at once. I would think that things like ethics reform, more transparency, sunshine laws, in light of the rampant abuse and corruption that has been exposed from Speaker Lee Chatfield to people like former Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky under criminal investigation for how they inappropriately used vast sums of money to advance political aims. I would look at tackling those, but even before those issues, the one issue that really surprised me that isn't on the list is common sense gun safety. That have, you know, those issues, red flag laws, waiting periods, things that have 80% support, that vast numbers of Republicans support, that is an immediate crisis. I mean, we just saw, you know, last year that horrible shooting in Oxford. We see it all the time. I think people are much more concerned about issues like that than they are concerned about issues like prevailing wage or right to work. But I guess my fear is that this agenda that was initially announced, now they're not limited to this only, but that it still speaks more to the game that people know rather than the game we're in. And we're in a game right now where there's a lot at stake, and we have zero-sum actors on the Republican side who are looking at really upending free and fair elections, corrupting the system, and really taking a callous attitude, almost an abetting attitude toward access to weapons that effectively become automatic weapons in the hands of people in schools. And that's a danger, a clear and present danger that they're not addressing.
While you're talking about Republicans and crime, one of the stories that really caught my attention this week is that the Attorney General, Dana Nessel, has reopened the state investigation into that slate of phony Trump electors, something she had handed off to the federal government. Looks to me like Dana Nessel is sending a message to Attorney General Merrick Garland.
I think that that's my read on it, too. We are now more than 2 years after the president of the United States and those in his close circle and allies in Congress and across the country tried to illegally usurp power and overturn, nullify a free and fair election. The danger, the threat that posed to the country, the rule of law and the Constitution, the danger that it still poses can't be understated. And the fact that we're 2 years into this and there's the accountability that is necessary for our rule of law system to survive still has not come. And so I support Dana Nessel's efforts to hold these people accountable. It wasn't a political stunt. It was a conspiracy to overturn the election, and somebody was pulling the strings. It wasn't all of these fake electors. They were just asked to sign a paper, didn't necessarily understand all of them what they were doing, but somebody did, and some of the people involved with it did, whether it's Romney McDaniel at the RNC, people with the Trump campaign, political bottom feeders like the Republican Party co-chair Michonne Maddock, certainly couldn't mastermind her way out of a paper bag, let alone overturn an election. But she probably has information on who's calling the shots, and that's what this criminal investigation can help expose. When they pull people in and question them under oath, somebody has information and they're going to start talking.
Before we wrap for this week, we probably need to do a little bit of eating of crow, and I will do it on behalf of Mark since he's not here. But the two of you kind of had a bad prediction when it came to Senator Gary Peters.
Well, Peters very successfully led the National Democratic Senatorial Committee in maintaining and actually adding one seat to its majority in kind of defiance of expectations. And there was after the election in November, there was a lot of people saying, boy, we really hope Gary Peters stays on in that role for another 2-year cycle. And Mark and I had both cautioned that, go out while you're on top. The grind of going out and raising money and supporting all these candidates in addition to your full-time job as a U.S. senator and a guy who really does roll up his sleeves and get down to business, that's a lot. And Gary had indicated early that he wasn't going to take another term. You know, thanks but no thanks was his reply. And so we thought we were validated. They apparently convinced him. He did such a good job. And a couple of days ago, it was announced that he will take the helm again for the 2024 cycle. That's going to be a tough cycle for Democrats nationally. The toughest one that they've faced in a generation, where they've got Democrat-held seats in Pennsylvania, where Bob Casey just announced he has prostate cancer. Hopefully he's able to recover and treat a treatable form of cancer, certainly. He's up in a re-election battle in a state that will be heavily contested at the presidential election level. So will Michigan. Now Debbie Stabenow's open seat. Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin. Wisconsin was the closest state out there last time around, along with Nevada and Arizona. Two other razor-thin states all have Democratic incumbents running.
Montana and West Virginia, which are solid red states, but somehow have Democrats as senators.
Right. And don't forget Ohio with Sherrod Brown. Ohio is a very red state now, is going to vote for the Republican candidate, likely Donald Trump. And Sherrod Brown has to get reelected in that state. And so it's a very tough map for the Democrats in 2024. But they've got somebody with a proven track record now. Gary Peters has defied expectations throughout his political career, and maybe he'll help the Democrats do it one more time. I hope he does, because democracy is depending on it.
Well, the Republicans have shown in recent elections they're really good at screwing it up. Maybe we'll get Sam Alito to come up with another United States Supreme Court ruling that works as a campaign issue, or maybe it'll be Jim Jordan will just overreach with his investigations. But it's going to be a fun 2 years. I'm glad we're going to be around for it. That's it for this week. Mark will be back next week, and I've enjoyed it, but glad to turn it back over to the pro.
Well, Walt, thank you so much. You're a pro yourself, no doubt about it. Thankfully, though, Mark is traveling by car and not airline on his vacation. Yeah. If the Republic is still standing, Mark and I will return next week. Thank you for giving us part of your day.
A Republic, If You Can Keep It, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.